Over the last few F1 seasons, we've had the specter of the Halo safety device hanging over our heads. With a few renditions proposed, tested, and almost universally despised by the fanbase and community, the most likely contender is a design that's seemingly based off a flip-flop. It looks like the 2018 Formula 2 cars will feature a version of the Halo, so how likely is it that we'll see this on a future Formula 1 contender? Today, we look at some other reactive regulation changes made in Formula 1, and take some time to think about the long-term impact those changes had, and what we can learn from them in the future. This is Garagista Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
Into second position on the last lap but one, and the French crowd aren't very happy.
The Halo device can be seen as a reaction to the terrible crash in the 2014 Japanese Grand Prix.
Welcome along then to the 30th World Championship Japanese Grand Prix. It's raining, and it is raining hard as we approach round 15 of the
The race was started late in the day in order to cater to Europe's viewing schedule on account of Japan's time zone. This, along with other delays, had the race running in really low light conditions. Heavy rains from a typhoon also produced variable conditions on track, and low cloud cover meant visibility had been reduced even further.
This afternoon.
In the rain, it's terrifying. In the dry, it's thrilling. But you get rivers around, obviously, with the contour changes in the pit lane, on the straights, and suddenly what was an easy bar with your foot flat out suddenly becomes a corner. Corners you have not been used to at any point in the week.
Late in the race, on lap 42 of 53, Adrian Sutil lost control of his Sauber in the long, fast Dunlop curve, sliding off the track into a tire wall.
Oh dear, and now we might get a safety car. Adrian Sutil has gone off into the barriers for what will be his seventh retirement of the season, and he was but a passenger when it happened.
This accident resulted in double-waved yellows at the corner, warning other drivers of the danger ahead and to be prepared to stop if necessary.
Sutil's seventh retirement, but where is the car? How quickly can they get out of the way? Are others going to be aquaplaning on or spinning off in the same point?
A tractor came out to retrieve Sutil's crash car from the circuit, and as that tractor was maneuvering the Sauber through a gap in the barriers, Jules Bianchi lost control of his Marussia at the same corner. The car slid off the track and collided with the rear of the tractor at 123 kilometers an hour, sliding under the vehicle and destroying the roll hoop in the process.
Makes Perez pits as well. The medical car indeed parked up by Adrian Sutil's Sauber.
The end of the story is far too familiar to F1 fans. If you're watching this race live, you'll recall the surreal feeling as it was red flagged. The commentators were quiet and unspeculative about the race halting crash, and the podium ceremony was somber, with no champagne spraying or exuberance.
That was not with marshals or something up there, with the truck going backwards.
Yeah, you wonder what's happened.
Yeah, something's not good up there.
Bianchi suffered a severe head injury from the collision and passed away months later, aged 25. The weeks and months following the Grand Prix and later Bianchi's passing were filled with questions and accusations. Why hadn't the safety car been called out? Why was the tractor not outfitted to protect from such an event? Why didn't Bianchi slow down enough? Why didn't the car protect his driver? Why did this promising, bright young man have to lose his life to a sport? All of these questions, despite being disrespectful to the Bianchi family or attempting to apportion blame to this party or that, are necessary to ask. Motorsport is always going to be dangerous, and there must always be a reason to question, how can this be safer while still being exciting? The Bianchi incident in Suzuka 2014, along with several IndyCar incidents involving debris coming in contact with the drivers, have put the safety focus on securing that part of the car, the open cockpit. So we find ourselves in 2017 with the Halo concept being tested. Though, before we make our minds up on the best way to secure the Open Cockpit racing machine, spoiler alert, we won't, let's examine some other reactive regulations pushed by the FIA that have been good, bad, and just ugly. When it comes to rule changes in F1, I find they come about in two ways.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering.
The first category can be summed up by saying, this is a problem and it requires a regulation change to be fixed. An example of this might be the Brabham fan car that ran in the 1978 Swedish Grand Prix and was regulated against on safety grounds. Also, it was just so much quicker than all the other cars. Or the banning of turbo engines for 1989 on the grounds of their high cost and possible danger. For the most part, these regulations seem to tackle familiar enemies. High cost, safety, a level playing field. The second category is, we need to influence a behavior, so let's introduce this regulation to make that happen. An example might be the power unit changes for the 2014 season, where the FIA wanted to pursue a more eco-friendly, sustainable image with smaller turbo engines. But we were left with a season of engine failures, frustrations, and a Mercedes winning 86% of the races in the next 3 years. Now, there were a number of circumstances that contributed to that outcome, but the problem here was the number of unforeseen consequences that tunnel vision on promoting a different engine of the sport caused. These kinds of changes tend to be hit or miss.
News coming out of Formula One this afternoon with the sport set to bring in potentially some major rule changes to make racing more exciting. So, Ted, what are the proposed changes?
One reactive rule change by the FIA came in time for the 2010 season and was actually a big win because it had a lot of positive effects and very few negatives.
The big talking point, of course, is the fuel and the weight of the car. It will have a huge significance if...
So you're talking about the changes to fuel, which is essentially no refueling.
The cars had just had a major shakeup in 2009 with brand new aero regulations, and for the 2010 season, the FIA banned refueling during the race. Every car starts the race with a full fuel load. Previously, cars would all be starting with different fuel loads, which could be used strategically by the teams. This regulation was made in the name of improving the show. A moniker that is applied to many of the rule changes from 2009 onwards. The idea was this. Saturday's qualifying would be more exciting since all the cars could run with minimum fuel and try to set the fastest lap, not just what stuck to the race strategy. And Sunday's race would be easier to follow since the fans wouldn't have to guess who was light or heavy on fuel. Plus, all the drivers should be driving flat out, meaning the racing would be interesting and exciting. True competition.
Halfway through. What is the big change with having no refueling during the race?
Well, you've got to carry that mass right from the lights going out, and obviously that's going to reduce as the race goes ahead. But that first set of tires that you use are carrying a lot more weight, the energy that's going into them and the brakes, and the driver has to manage that. So
the car that qualifies will have no fuel, just enough fumes to get it back to the pits after its fast run. The car that starts the race will be 5 seconds per lap slower. Yeah. Because they'll add 25% weight to the car. It'll be much heavier, as David said.
So did it work? Pretty much, yeah. For one thing, it did make the races a lot easier to follow. I'll rewatch some races from previous years and have trouble remembering who should be fast, when, and so on. Now, since the playing field is more level from the race start, the race in action is easier to keep track of.
It's lights out and away we go. The Mercedes get away very well indeed. Tended from Carlos Sainz, but Hamilton goes into the lead. Now we're looking to Sebastian Vettel and Valtteri Bottas. Vettel gets into the first turn just ahead of the Mercedes. It's Hamilton who leads with Vettel. Ricciardo pressurizes Kimi Raikkonen as well. And Sebastian Vettel just eases ahead.
No refueling also had the added benefit of giving us today's pit stops. Previously, the limiting factor of how long a car was stopped was how fast the fuel could enter the tank.
The second stage handles and pull that up and off the car, but that all has to be done very fast because normally you're the last person they're waiting for before the car can leave. So the engine's revving, it's ready to go, so as soon as you're off, the car leaves the pits.
With that out of the question, it's all down to the speed and skill of the mechanics. The fact that these guys can get 4 10-kilogram-plus wheels off, back on, and the car on its way in under 2 seconds is just incredible. I know that you see it hundreds of times during the season, but it's really a feat and something people notice. When I watch a race with a friend unfamiliar to the sport, they always make a comment on the pit stop. Perhaps that's exactly what improving the show is, right? No refueling also meant the teams didn't have to develop and travel with expensive refueling rigs. Sure, there was some development money put into the jacks, wheel nuts, and impact guns to save a few milliseconds here and there, but it must be peanuts compared to the cost of putting that fuel in the cars. Another benefit was the safety aspect. How many pit lane fires have we seen since 2010? The moral of the story is that this was pretty much a slam dunk. Of course, you can make the case that it forced some fuel-saving practices these days, which some regard as dulling the race, but overall it exposed new strategies and made the sport better. So one regulation that came to be to improve the show has worked out pretty well. What about some other ones?
Quite another question. Gentlemen, a short view back to the past. 30 years ago, Niki Lauda told us, take a trike, a monkey, place him into the cockpit, and he is able to drive the car. Is Formula One driving today too complicated? Are you too much under effort, under pressure? What are your wishes for the future concerning the technical program during the race? Less buttons, more, or less and more communication with your engineers?
Sometimes the best solution to a problem is the simplest one, the one that's right in front of your face. In the latter half of the 2014 season, Formula One issued a technical directive to limit the instruction from the engineers on the pit wall to the drivers on the track. Just before the Singapore Grand Prix, the FIA released a full list of what messages were acceptable and what weren't. Although it was still acceptable for the engineers to update the drivers on yellow flags or pit stops, no longer could they suggest different racing lines or give updates on other drivers' performances or instruct the driver on how to fix an issue, among plenty of other things.
Can you explain the restrictions that the teams had to cope with?
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, what they wanted to see was the drivers in charge of the car. So before we could coach them on, you know, a couple of years ago, we could even coach them on driving style, how to approach a corner, what gear to use. That all got clamped down. And this was about stopping us coaching them on how to manage the car in terms of fuel or the energy management. And we'd done more and more over the years, and it just got to a point where the FIA and Formula One decided enough was enough and let's see the drivers back in control.
Now, the justification for the implementation of these team radio restrictions is an article in the Sporting Regulations stating, "The driver must drive the car alone and unaided." The race director, Charlie Whiting, confirmed this by saying, "What we're trying to do is make sure that the driver is driving the car on his own, that he's not being told how to drive the car."
I was really trying to understand what the ban would mean in terms of, you know, what they can and cannot say to us. It is a big change. Whether or not I agree with all the implications, I think it's definitely going to make it a lot harder. We have to memorize a lot more things. You know, there's so many different processes which we have to go through, or sequences we have to go through in the car. So we're just trying to figure out ways in which we can try to remember them. So sometimes you'll see stickers in the car, you'll see stickers on the steering wheel, and some of it is of no benefit in terms of improving our pace or anything like that. It's just to keep the car going because it is so technical. So that's why I was saying some of them I don't agree with because it's irrelevant to the pace of the car or to the spectators.
This may make sense in the outset, but it was not as if the engineers were telling the drivers when to brake and accelerate for each corner. The drivers are still responsible for the vast majority of the driving performance. The real reason for the jarring mid-season rule change was the FIA's report of getting many, many complaints from viewers who were fed up of hearing the continual engineering assistance the drivers were getting. So, this comes back to improving the show. The FIA wanted to improve the show for viewers by making it seem like the drivers were really in complete control of their vehicles, solving problems on the fly, besting other drivers on pure skill, all that. The problem with this reasoning, though, is that if viewers were tired of hearing coaching from the pit wall, why not just not broadcast those messages while still running the good stuff?
I'm out! Crash! Somebody hit me in the rear, turn two, and then somebody hit me in the rear again in turn three, for sake. Honestly, what the are we doing here?
You like my pace? You like it? You're doing well, Checo. Pace is good.
No 15, no vaccine. I'm so sick, my 10 bars cough. Now I'm off.
Hold up.
Now, put on your tinfoil hats with me for a moment. Perhaps the reason given for the radio restrictions was a front, and the hope of this technical directive was to introduce more uncertainty, more variability into the racing. This was during a year where one team was essentially guaranteed to win. Wouldn't the racing be more exciting if one of those cars had an issue that the driver couldn't fix, allowing other teams to catch up?
Rod, something's happened to Rosberg. Yeah. He's lost a monstrous amount of time. He's lost up more than 3 seconds.
Yeah, perhaps he has. You're right. Exactly on that, Lee. 3 seconds. A 39.1 was his last lap. Hamilton.
Driver default 1-0-1. Chassis default 0-1. Chassis default 0-1.
Are you allowed to tell the club that?
Can't tell him.
I don't think you are.
Yeah.
And look at this. Verstappen's back in the game for a second. How close is Verstappen now? Is he going to get that second spot back inside 5 laps to the checkered flag?
Boy, it's going to be a stretch.
So, did it work? Was the racing more exciting, more genuine? In a word, no. Sure, there were some race starts where the drivers bogged down due to having the clutch bite point settings wrong, or there were some moments where drivers fell back due to a transmission problem they couldn't fix, but so many other parts of the restriction backfired. The sport looked like it was overregulated to a new viewer, with teams grappling over whether or not they could say things to their driver. It added a layer of complexity to the sport that was already so complex. Teams were on the radio less, and driving performances were suffering. Not to mention, the vagueness of the directive meant there were so many ways around these regulations.
Turn one, okay? Not sure I can comment on turn one, Lewis. Is the weather good? Yeah, so the weather looks good.
So what?
Oh, nice dear. One, Lewis.
So this rule change just wasn't working, and after a year or two of complaints from teams, backlash from broadcasters, and drivers calling it a joke, the FIA withdrew most of the restrictions. Now teams are back to coaching drivers and helping them go faster, and the broadcasting team just doesn't put through those messages. This is a great example of the second type of regulating, trying to promote something by introducing regulation, and in this case, it just fell flat. There were some bright spots from the change, though. Drivers are still not allowed direction on their starts. So, when we see a race start, we aren't seeing which team has the best clutch system, but we're seeing which drivers are best at starting. And that's what it's all about.
Was it something that somebody said? Honey, you know we broke the rule.
So, the radio ban wasn't great, but it wasn't all bad. What was something that was all bad?
G'day and welcome to the Australian Grand Prix qualifying notebook. And only Formula One could get itself into this kind of mess. And haven't we been here before with daft ideas that haven't worked out?
Just before the 2016 season kicked off in March, the FIA announced a new qualifying format. What was dubbed elimination qualifying saw a change from the knockout format that had been run since 2006. Instead of the slowest group of drivers being knocked out at the end of Q1 and Q2, the slowest driver would be eliminated every 90 seconds, with the remaining progressing to further rounds. This change was the perfect example of trying to fix something that had nothing wrong with it in the first place.
I'm not a fan, personally not a fan of the qualifying, and I think speaking for on behalf of all the drivers, no driver is. We don't get what's wrong with the old qualifying and why to change it. I think it's...
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Now, this is not the mantra of Formula One, or racing for that matter. Teams are always looking for ways to improve, gain a tenth here and there, push technology and people to their limits. That means improving where you're strong and reconciling your weaknesses. Take Audi and their Le Mans campaign a few years back. They weren't going to beat the Toyotas on pure pace, but they could be more reliable than them, run longer with fewer pit stops. Colin Chapman couldn't beat the big names with his engine, but he could with his chassis and aero. They improved on their strengths. This change to qualifying was not improving on its strengths. No fans, no teams, no drivers had asked for a change to the qualifying format. And on the eve of the season that held so much potential, with the two Mercedes drivers duking it out one last time in their machines before a regulation shakeup, and Red Bull and Ferrari threatening from behind, this was just unnecessary fluff.
I just don't think they're particularly special. I don't think it's going to add
to the spectacle for the fans, and that's really what we got to do, I think.
The whole concept had the air of being an idea that some important person came up with in a boardroom, and all of their subordinates were too afraid to tell them it was a stupid idea, so it happened anyways. Now, given this glowing intro, you can imagine how elimination qualifying played out. Pretty bad. Really bad. The first race in Melbourne 2016 ran the elimination qualifying, much to the dismay of the teams. And it was just a disaster, because the teams did not behave as the format expected them to behave. Ideally, there would always be cars on track throughout the qualifying session, with everyone trying to be that much faster so they're not knocked out. What really happened was the team sent their cars out to set a fast lap, and then sat in the garage to save tires and reduce wear on the car. Each qualifying session ended with the cars sitting in their garages, and no action out on track. Compare this to the format that was ditched. Sure, there were times when there were no drivers on track, but at the end of qualifying was always interesting to watch, as the front runners were getting that one fast lap in at the end of Q3, and we had the suspense as we wondered who would put it on pole. It's exciting and climactic. The farce that was elimination qualifying was tried once more at the Bahrain Grand Prix, and with similar results, they then ditched it for the rest of the season, and hopefully ever. So what was the underlying problem with this move by the FAA for mixing up quali? My theory is that someone was comparing the numbers between Saturday and Sunday for a GP weekend, and they decided Saturday's figures needed a boost. We need X to happen, so let's try this. We need Saturdays to have increased viewership and ticket sales, so let's try this new idea. The problem here is that the people tuning into qualifying are the really engaged fans, enthusiasts, aficionados. It's not that qualifying wasn't or isn't interesting, it's just that people tuning into Sunday's broadcast tend to be more casual viewers, catching the big event. Instead of playing to the strengths of Saturday's broadcast, the management tried to improve the weakness, and it just didn't work. What did work with qualifying was the introduction of a free set of tires for the frontrunners to use in Q3, allowing them to go all out with no need to worry about starting the race on destroyed tires. What also might work is making improved graphics for qualifying and increasing the viewing experience for those diehard fans. Improve where you're strong. The Halo device looks to be coming to a Formula One car near you sometime very soon. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? If you read a lot of the press today, you might conclude that it's a negative addition to the sport. It'll make the cars look silly. It will only introduce more danger with blind spots. It won't actually protect the driver. Now, I'm not able to comment on the effectiveness of the Halo device in its current rendition. I don't know how well it will protect from future incidents involving the cockpit, and I don't think its viability should be based on how effective it would have been in past incidents. What I do know is that the Halo is not very Formula One. It is not an elegant solution to the problem. That isn't a requirement, certainly, but there must be a more efficient way to secure the driver's head. The virtual safety car was a step in the right direction, minimizing dangers around the circuit are another. Unfortunately, there's just no surefire solution to this problem, and that's why the Halo puts such a bad taste in my and a lot of fans' mouths. Because it seems like a half-assed way for the organizers to pat themselves on the back for improving safety when there's truly no guarantee. So, the conclusion of this episode, insofar as the Halo is concerned, is indecisive. On one hand, at least the FIA is taking time with this by testing it and gathering feedback. But on the other hand, what if that time, energy, and money is better spent on other solutions? What if all of this is for naught? Racing focuses on the big wins, the simple solutions with large payoffs, improving on strengths. These are lessons learned from previous changes that should be acknowledged in the future. Thanks for listening to this episode. Garagista Radio strives to be different by telling the stories of motorsport that captivate us, and not just preview and recap each race with the same storylines we hear everywhere. We'll be doing more episodes like this and a track walk segment before F1 race weekends. If you like this episode, please consider subscribing to us and leave us a review so we can know what we can do better. Thanks again.